So, just so that you know, I am aware that it is December and that it's almost Christmas that we celebrate, and that I am not preaching on Christmas, the subject of Christmas today. I am preaching on the other part of it, that is Christ's anticipating his death, burial, and resurrection, which is why he came. So it's really fitting that we are dealing with this now, because we are able to think through why it was that he came in the incarnation. But also we need to think about some other matters. There's no small amount of trouble that we can cause for ourselves in the various contexts of life that we experience. And I'm thinking particularly of someone like Judas. We saw last week how he had formally betrayed Jesus in front of friends and many others as well, and made a name for himself. Not a particularly positive one, however. And then there was Peter. He also found himself in a precarious position with a little blood on his hands, due to rather poor execution of a defensive move, as you may recall. It seems that his bold and crude response would soon be overshadowed by a colossal failure due to his total lack of confidence. So on the one hand, it looks like, boy, Peter is really brave. He's got his sword out. He's ready to take on the world. And then he chickens out in front of a servant girl and others. There may be something we can learn from his unfortunate experience of failure. So there are two themes that are running parallel in this passage. One relates to Jesus and his questioners, and the other relates to Peter and his questioners, with quite different results. And I think it's helpful for us to think about that. There's questioning going on. One is Jesus being questioned, the other is Peter is being questioned. And Jesus answered well, and he ended up dead. And Peter answered poorly, and he still lived, but was a bit sad about the results of that. Just an interesting way to think about it. So we want to think about the trial and denial context. Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. We had seen previously that that's what was coming. And then we have this basic statement, sort of a summary of what had transpired, where some of the other Gospels go into a little more detail on that. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And we talked about that previously in the Gospel of John as well. But it's kind of giving us a little bit of context here. So first of all, the context of the first trial, and then the formal arrest of Jesus. John provides us a brief description of the arrest. He refers to the captain or commander of the troops. The term there is kiliarchos. It was the officer in charge of the Roman cohort soldiers. So that term is descriptive enough to be able to identify who it is, and it's kiliarchos. So it's like a thousand, or ruler of a thousand, head of a thousand, is what that basically means. It doesn't mean they were all there. It just means that's what his formal designation is as the commander there. And he would have been the person with probably the most official authority on the scene, because he had sort of national endorsement for him and his position. And then there's a reference to the binding of Jesus, that he was bound. It may be, some suggest, maybe an allusion to Isaiah 53:7, where it reads that Messiah's enemies would lead him as a lamb to the slaughter. According to the synoptics, the disciples abandoned Jesus immediately after this arrest when he was taken into custody. Matthew 26:56 and Mark 14:50. And the text of Isaiah seems quite closely to picture the events that Jesus experienced throughout the process of these trials and so on. He was abandoned by his own disciples. He was betrayed by one of them. And then there was yet more that was to come that had significance. The Jewish officers also played a part in Jesus' arrest. They were acting on behalf of the instigators of all of this, that is, the Jewish leaders, those who were in charge of things. And since the servant of the high priest was present, they were likely handpicked to ensure that things were handled as desired. I mean, if you have a servant of the high priest, then he's kind of driving things. He wants to make sure some of his own people are there, seeing how things go. And it was known to John that the man whose ear was severed was the high priest's servant. How did he know that? I don't think he was wearing a name tag that said, "Hello, my name is." John likely had a closer connection for some reason that we'll think about. John also identifies the chief religious leaders who examined Jesus. And so this would indicate that he would have been an eyewitness, that there was eyewitness testimony to these events. And he would later, in his gospel, would indicate that he was the one that is testifying of this, and his testimony is true. So he's trying to show some validation. And that's why he's giving some of these details, to ensure that you recognize that this is for real. And he is testifying in a formal way to that end. So then we have the examination before Annas. John's the only gospel to mention the trial before Annas. And it was preliminary to his appearance before Caiaphas and then the Sanhedrin. So there were three religious trials that they referred to them as that, questioning, whatever, whether formal or informal, is a question of which terminology you want to use. So it was before Annas. That's referenced in John 18, 12 to 14, and 19 to 24. And then before Caiaphas, that was Matthew 26, 57 to 68, Mark 14, 53 to 65, and Luke 22, 54, and then 63 to 65. And if you happen to have your outline, you should have those, and you can go check them out, and you can compare and do your own little analysis. And then before the Sanhedrin, that's referenced in Matthew 27, 1, Mark 15, 1, and Luke 22, 66 to 71. And then there were three civil trials, we'll deal with those later, before Pilate, and then Herod Antipas, and then Pilate again. So that's a lot of trial activity going on, or questioning, seeking to put Jesus in the place where they could justify doing what they wanted to do to him. That's what it really amounted to. And if you didn't get enough of the answer that you wanted from one person, then you'd send them to somebody else and see if you can get a little more. And if they don't give you what you want, then you send them to somebody else. That's really what's going on here. Just wanted to keep pushing him to the place where they could get somebody to convict and incarcerate or eliminate him. And in this case, the reference to the soldiers, evidently they led Jesus to the residence of the high priest. And I would suggest that we would want to use the terminology high priest emeritus. He would have been the father of father-in-law of Caiaphas and the father of some of the others that had served, as we'll see. Now, the location of this site is unknown, though there is a traditional site in the southern part of Old Jerusalem, just west of the Tyropian Valley. The high priest's situation needs some clarification, some explanation. So, practically speaking, there were two acting high priests at the time. It's assumed that both high priests occupied the same building and were related. They had their name on the door, you know, high priest official, high priest emeritus. Picture it that way. It might help you keep it straight. Annas was the former high priest, and he was one that the Jews still regarded as the legitimate high priest, since the understanding from the Mosaic law was that the priesthood was for life. Annas served as the official high priest from AD 6 to 15, And then the Roman procurator, Valerius Grantus, deposed him. And then five of Annas' sons, plus his son-in-law Caiaphas, succeeded him in this office. So it was natural for the Jews to regard him as the patriarch or the true high priest. He was the one that had the clout. He was the one that had history. And so people wanted to know, what do you think about this? You've been around a long time. And so he continued to exert a considerable amount of influence throughout his lifetime. But his son-in-law, Caiaphas, was placed in office by the Romans in A.D. 18. And he remained there until A.D. 36. And the year that we're talking about here would have been A.D. 33, at least in the common reckoning. And the thing to keep in mind there is the calendars have changed a bit over time. And so the marking of time hasn't been consistent. So we need to recognize that. Then we come to the proclamation of Caiaphas. The reference to that John makes here that he had said that one man should die for the people and not everyone suffer for the issues that he's causing for them. So John seems to have referenced Caiaphas as he did here to remind his readers of the prediction of Jesus' substitute sacrifice, because Jesus had indicated that, and then the reference that Caiaphas makes here also indicates someone should die for the people. That's substitution. We would recognize that. And this statement would have influenced the Sanhedrin's verdict to come after the high priest's conclusions, because he had that kind of influence as the official high priest at this time. And it was a legitimate way in their thinking of a way to look at it. And the statement was essentially true, and it was prophetic. And it effectively summarized the purpose of Jesus, that is to die for us in our place. And we all benefit from that reality, even if he didn't really know what he was saying. If he was thinking of it in one way, but he said more than he knew. So as we also want to recognize, the trial events are alternated with Peter's denial events as well. So this text and the other Gospels go back and forth. And as I pointed out, there's a questioning of Jesus, there's a questioning of Peter, and they're kind of intermixed here. Looking at verses 15 and 16, and Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood at the door outside. Then the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. And that's when things get a little more interesting. Then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the servant and officers who had made a fire of coals stood there, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves. Now, when I read that, I am reminded of how similar the weather conditions and the geography and things in Israel are compared to where we are here. And when the sun goes down, you know it. It gets cold. That's just the way it is. And so we can recognize that is a very familiar scenario. And Peter stood with them and warmed himself. So if you're trying to imagine, what would it have been like? Just think about what our conditions are like, and it's quite similar for that time of year, which would have been spring around the time of Passover. Then we come to the first denial of Peter. The connections of another disciple brought closer contact. So at some point after first dispersing, Peter and another disciple begin to follow Jesus to see what is going on. And they may have tried to go at what they thought was a safe distance, but yet following, because it was a bigger crowd, they had torches, probably wouldn't have been too difficult to see. And apparently they followed the arresting party back to Jerusalem to the high priest's palace or courtyard area of it. And traditionally, commentators have understood that the other disciple would have been the Apostle John, the beloved disciple. And he's referenced that way in John 13, 24, 19, 26, 27, 22 to 9, 21, 1, and 20 to 23, and 24 to 25. Just so you can kind of recognize, there's a number of places where he had that distinction. But there have been more recent people who have questioned how John could have had a close relationship with the high priest, because their thinking is, well, he was just a simple fisherman from Galilee. How could he have such a connection with Annas, the high priest? But it's entirely possible that John, being the son of a generally understood to be prosperous fisherman, did have such a relationship. It's also quite possible that he may have been related. You know how relationships go when you get together for one of the many different celebrations that they had. They would have had some point of connection. And so that's not that unusual. We also know that Salome, the mother of John, was a sister of Mary, Jesus' mother. If you look at John 19:25 and compare it with Mark 15:40. And then would have been equally related to Elizabeth, whose husband Zechariah was a priest, Luke 1:36. So again, you can see some connections there. And the New Testament does present Peter and John as having a close relationship, because they've had various connections in other passages that are noted as well, particularly referenced in John and in Acts. So we assume that the traditional view is correct. Though the identity isn't essential to this particular passage, but I think that's pretty good indication that that is who it was. It was John. The result of this connection brought closer contact, because John had an in, and so he could get closer to things, because, you know, it was probably a relative in some way. So he was able to get in closer, see what was going on, and then Peter, because of his connection with John, was able to sort of sneak in on his coattails and kind of see what's going on. And so John was able to follow Jesus into the courtyard, and he just flashed his ID badge, you know, like you do at Sandy in order to get in and do everything you have to do. Or he just said, oh, that's my uncle, that's my cousin, that's my, you know, whatever. There was a casual denial of association with Jesus. It seems that John was not afraid to enter with Jesus because he had some familiarity. That seems evident. Peter remained at the door wondering what to do, kind of just thinking, do I dare go in? Do I stay outside? What do I do? Do I go get lunch? There's nothing open at this hour. What do I do? So John took the initiative to bring Peter in at this point. And then Peter's identity is questioned. He didn't have his little badge, or there was something else about him that sort of gave him away. And so the girl at the door wanted to see some ID. Who is this guy? And she seemed to be a threat to Peter. And Peter was now feeling very vulnerable at this point. There's probably a couple reasons for that that we'll consider. Her question seemed to expect a negative answer. It also seemed to possibly reflect some disdain for Jesus. You aren't also one of his disciples, are you? I mean, that would be awful if you were, is the inference. And so she made it easy for Peter to say no. Oh, no way, huh? No, I don't have any association there. Oh, you're sneaking in with John. Well, did she know that John was one of the disciples? Interesting thought. But he clearly indicated no affiliation with Jesus. No. He denied being a disciple. He didn't deny that Jesus was the Messiah, but he denied being a disciple, because that part of it didn't come up at this point. And so Peter seemed to try to blend into his surroundings. He not only denied Jesus at this point, but he also stood among the enemies, so to speak. But then the night air was kind of cool, and there was the presence of this fire, and he's thinking, you know, it's kind of late, it's kind of dark, it's kind of cold. I think I'm going to warm up by these other people. I'll just kind of blend in and pretend like I'm one of them, and they'll never know the difference. And you got to think, well, if you have a fire in the open air, you need to be pretty close to it in order to get the benefit of it. I mean, you stand 20 yards away, you're not going to get much. So he had to get in closer to the fire. And there's a sense in which you could argue, well, the closer he got to the fire, the further he got away from Jesus and his affiliation with him, at least in sort of a metaphorical sense. Now, there would be another fire later on the beach in another chapter, chapter 21. And that might remind Peter of this occasion of being by the fire and his denials. And maybe a reminder of the hazard of taking your eyes off of Jesus and focusing on circumstances that Peter had had some occasion to do previously, like when he was given the opportunity to walk on the water, and then he wasn't looking at Jesus, he was looking at his circumstances. And we kind of tend to do that. When it's convenient, we look at Jesus. And when it's not, or when there are other distractions, then we're kind of focusing on those things and kind of forget, oh yeah, Jesus fits in this picture somewhere too. And so it's sort of I guess that's one of the things I like about Peter. He's so much like one of us in so many ways. And he has so many experiences that graphically illustrate different truths and how easy it is to mess up and rely on our own strength and to fall and to fail so easily and so far. So we can relate to that. And hopefully we can learn from his errors to not duplicate them, but that doesn't always work. The trial and denial significance, verses 19 to 21. The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. You see, we switch back and forth here between the questioning of Jesus, the questioning of Peter. Jesus answered him, I spoke openly to the world. I also taught in synagogues and in the temple, where the Jews always meet. And in secret, I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said. You have to think about, what was he getting at there? I mean, if this is a trial, what's he calling on? Witnesses. Check it out. You're not going to take my word for it anyway. The interrogation regarding followers and teaching. So there was a concern about Jesus' influence. Through his followers, Annas, as the unofficial high priest, was conducting the initial questioning, sort of an informal inquiry. He was the go-to guy for answers. In an unofficial capacity, but nonetheless with authority. He was probably asking about the disciples to determine the size of the following. How many people has this guy won over to his way of thinking? And one of the chief concerns of the religious leaders was the power of Jesus' popularity. Did he have more popularity than they did? And how much of a threat was that? And then there was a concern about his influence through his teaching. There was concern over Jesus' teaching, perhaps because what was Jesus claiming and what kind of error might he be communicating to the people? Is he leading them astray? Is he putting them in a place that might jeopardize the working situation they have with the Roman government? That was often a big issue. There was probably the understanding that Jesus was a political insurrectionist. And you know what that's like. Oh, you don't. Well, a few years ago, never mind, I won't. Annas was the, as I said, the high priest emeritus with this patriarchal influence. And so he had this outsized, unofficial but very practical authority. That's why he was brought into this equation. They thought, well, if anybody can get something out of him, out of Jesus, then this is the guy because he's got years of experience. So the leaders of the time wanted to get his experiential input, his intellectual input, because they respected him. He had shown himself to be someone that was trustworthy, that they could depend on, and they were convinced he was on their side and would get Jesus to admit to whatever they thought he was guilty of. So if they could get Annas to come up with some reason for putting an end to Jesus, either his influence or his life, whatever it took, if they could get that broader base of approval or disapproval, that would make it much easier to put an end to him. So that's why they were bringing him in, and the others as well. But what they failed to take into account was there was another authority in the room who actually had more authority than Annas, because they were holding Annas up like, this guy, he's been around a long time, he knows what's going on. I mean, he was like Gandalf. I mean, he was the chief wizard. Whatever. But Jesus was there. And his authority is still going to show through in some way or another, as we have seen before. And so Jesus then had an opportunity to respond. There was confession of no attempt to hide his actions. Jesus affirmed that he had openly shared and he had done so publicly, and he was not promoting sedition secretly. This was not a denial that he had taught his disciples privately, but that he had not in any way done anything subversive of the established powers, either in his actions or in his teachings. And he had asked why they had not consulted his hearers. So he invited Annas to question those who heard him, because there were plenty who had, not just his disciples, but the other people. What did they have to say about what he had said? Did he incriminate himself to them? And again, the testimony of witnesses was an indispensable part of any serious trial in Judaism, so they would have respected that idea, but they didn't seek it at this point, other than come up with some false people later because they couldn't get what the answer they wanted. So Jesus was assuring Annas that he was not an anarchist. He was not anti-Jewish. He was not interested in causing trouble, which was their assumption. Then John 18, beginning at verse 22. And we had said these things. One of the officers who stood by Jesus struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, do you answer the high priest like that? Jesus answered him, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me? Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. And we should read in between there, because he didn't get the answers he wanted. The response of Jesus to his mistreatment. An incensed officer accosted Jesus physically and verbally. The officer here, the word is hyperteron, hyperton. He struck Jesus. He was probably one of the Jewish temple police. And he interpreted Jesus' response as being discourteous, and therefore it gave him an excuse to strike him. And the word there means a blow, or to strike sharply with the palm of the hand. And you can kind of picture what that might have looked like. The man who struck Jesus was not treating him fairly, because it was probably more bullying, or being more of a brutal kind of treatment, because Jesus really hadn't shown disrespect to Annas. He was just seeking the truth. Someone has observed, the truth is always objectionable to those who are concerned to establish a case at all costs. It is easier and more effective to answer it with blows than with arguments. And we recognize how that works. And we probably could take a lesson on how not to respond in such a case. Probably not a good idea to approach things that way. But we sometimes do, because it's easy to get emotionally involved and lose your cool. And we should take a lesson from this to say, that's probably not the right thing to do. It's not a good thing to do. It wasn't a good thing to do then. It isn't a good thing to do now. We do well to pay attention to that. An offended Jesus responded with a reasonable question. And Jesus' response to this attack was logical rather than emotional or physical. Now, some of us, if we had been slapped in the face, might have been inclined to return in kind. But Jesus didn't. He simply appealed for a fair trial. Bring on the witnesses. Prove what it is that you are saying one way or another. Now, Jesus knew that he was going to have to endure this kind of treatment. But he could still communicate the need for reasonableness. And he could still model and expect proper treatment, even while being mistreated, with much more to come. There was a need to provide a proper basis for the arrest. Annas could not produce anything that the Sanhedrin could use to condemn him, because it would be sent on to the Sanhedrin, the main ruling body, the Supreme Court, so to speak. Annas came up with nothing, and so he then sent Jesus on to Caiaphas, hoping that maybe another shot by somebody else might work. The descriptions of Jesus' hearings in the Gospels alternate between Jesus' interrogations and Peter's denials as well. And it seems clear that Annas and Caiaphas lived and interviewed Jesus probably in the same parts of the same building, same residence, maybe palace. Caiaphas had to interview Jesus in order to bring legally sufficient charges before the Sanhedrin, since Caiaphas was the official high priest. And John noted here also that Jesus remained bound as a criminal, even though he had done nothing that warranted such physical restraint. John didn't record what happened to Jesus when he appeared before Caiaphas and later before the Sanhedrin. He focused more on Annas, and the others didn't deal with that. Maybe that's why, because the others didn't, and the others had dealt with the other. He omitted the aspects of Jesus' three-part religious trial because the other Gospels had adequately communicated them, and it wasn't necessarily part of his main point at this juncture. It may be that John considered the meeting of the Sanhedrin that he had described in chapter 11, 47 to 53 as Jesus' official condemnation because the Sanhedrin had already come to a conclusion that they were done with him and they wanted to get rid of him. And all of this, again, shows that the case against Jesus was contrived. They didn't really have anything to work with. They were trying to come up with something. And they were struggling to come up with reasonable evidence of sedition or some actual wrongdoing. And we appreciate the fact that Jesus was not guilty of wrongdoing in God's eyes. Only those who were trying to come up with it, those who were predisposed to opposing him. And those who opposed him were actually the truly guilty ones. And then actually we could put ourselves in that boat as well, because we're all fallen and helpless sinners. But they were doubly guilty because they outright rejected him. And he was right there. They didn't believe him. They didn't believe in him. They didn't recognize him as the Son of God, the Messiah, the promised one, which they could have, they should have. There were some among them who did, but they rejected him. And so they were guilty as sinners, and they were guilty as rejectors of the truth standing right in front of them. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me," and they were denying that. Verses 25 to 27. Now Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. So we've got a meanwhile. Peter's warming himself by the fire. Therefore they said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of him whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Then Peter denied again, and immediately a rooster crowed. Now, this is, again, sort of a condensed version covering the basic details. Some of the other texts go into a little bit more detail, but we know the picture of what is going on here. The response of Peter to further questioning. There was a second outright denial of being a disciple. The scene switches back again to Peter in the courtyard. He's warming himself with the high priest's servants and other officers there. And he's again questioned. And he again folds under pressure. He didn't gain any boldness, any courage from standing by the fire. It seems to have melted him more, not strengthened him. So he may have been denying not only Jesus, but also he may have been denying his affiliation with John. If John was a known disciple among some of the relatives, if they were his relatives, and that's the reason that he would have known the high priest, the question emphasizes also one of his disciples. Looking to Matthew 10:33, Mark 14:69. So it seems that Peter was more concerned about trying to fit in with his new friends around the fire. You know, having a fireside chat, staying warm, getting comfortable. So he knew identifying with Jesus could be a real problem. And so his former courage, when he pulled out his sword, sort of disappeared. And the accuser this time was also a girl, according to Matthew 26:71 and Mark 14:69. And Jesus provides a dramatic contrast here. Jesus is seen as standing up to his questioners and denying nothing. And Peter cowers before his questioners and denies everything. And this is in front of some really intimidating people. Or so he seemed to think. Now, this is a good spot for us to think. What would I have done if I were in that situation? What if I were in Peter's shoes or sandals at that time? What would I have done? Could I have stood up to that and said, "I am a follower to the death"? Wait, he did say that, but not when he needed to. Could I have done any better? will I do any better if I find myself in that situation, which could very well be, since things are deteriorating in our society rather rapidly before our eyes. There was a third outright denial of being with Jesus. The third accuser was a relative of Malchus, whose ear Peter had cut off in the garden. Apparently that made a memory. I would think it would. Only John recorded this relationship because it, again, assumes he was an eyewitness of the events, and he had other connections here as well. And this, again, would support the idea that John was the other disciple. He knew the relationships of people within the priest's household and may have been, again, related himself. That would explain why he would have known these relationships more than some of the other records had recorded. And this accuser identifies Peter as being in the garden with Jesus, and he had good reason to have taken notice because it was a relative of his whose ear had been hacked off by Peter. And then this third accuser also identified Peter as a Galilean, according to Matthew 26:73, Mark 14:70, and Luke 22:57. So several other places where that's referenced. And this question posed the greatest threat to Peter's security. He was concerned about being arrested for the attempted murder of Malchus. He had a lot of things to think about. What he had done. Was he going to be held accountable for that? So he's a little bit concerned about letting it out that, yeah, you're the guy, and I saw you, and you were there. And so Peter responded by uttering his most vehement denial of the three, if you look at the other corresponding passages. Again, John's account is a little more subdued and abbreviated. And so there was a reminder of the prediction of denial. Immediately after this denial, a rooster crowed. And this would have been, according to Mark 14:72, the second time. This fulfilled the prediction that Jesus had spoken just hours earlier, John 13:38, that you will deny me. John also admits some of the details recorded elsewhere. He doesn't deal with Peter's oaths and curses, as are dealt with in Matthew and Mark. He doesn't deal with the convicting look that Jesus gave him, according to Luke 22:61, or Peter's bitter tears of contrition, Matthew 26:75, Mark 14:72, and Luke 22:62. There's a lot there to take in. The effect is that the fulfillment of Jesus' prediction receives the emphasis. Because he didn't deal with those other things, it's the fulfillment that then shows through. The point for us is to note the ease with which Peter failed to maintain his courage and denied Christ, which in some ways should freak us out. This was Peter. This was the guy who said, I will follow you to the death no matter what. Have you ever said that? Have you ever thought that? There's nothing that's going to stop me. And then you get in the middle of it and it's like, I don't think so. That's scary. This was Peter. The bold guy who hacked off an ear. He was so sure that he would not fail. And yet, in the heat of the moment, he did. He failed miserably. To be restored later, but he failed miserably. And we can do the same when the pressure is on. And who knows when we might find ourselves in that same position. Can we stand up for Christ? Can we stand up for his truth? Can we stand up under threat of harm or death or financial loss or you name it? We may have opportunities to find out sooner than we wish to.